Welcome to Behind the Books, a new podcast from IVP Academic.
In each episode, we take you behind the scenes of scholarly publishing with conversation about particular IVP Academic books, as well as broader publishing industry topics.
I'm Alexandra Horn, Marketing Manager for IVP Academic.
And this is John Boyd, Academic Editorial Director.
It may seem easy to judge a book by its cover, but on Behind the Books, we take the posture of curious learners in order to demystify some of the aspects of our industry that are all too often hidden or accessible only to the few.
Behind every book stand many, many people, not only authors, but also editors, designers, marketers, and salespeople, among others.
On the Behind the Books podcast, we want to explore the humanity behind and within the publishing process, enjoying the intellectual and faith journeys that have brought us to a one-of-a-kind calling.
In this, our first season of Behind the Books, we focus on one milestone publication recently released, the second edition of the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters, what we affectionately call the DPL2.
We think the best way to do that is to hand the mic, literally, to the three-volume editors, the biblical scholars Scott McKnight, Lynn Kohick, and Nijay Gupta.
For 11 episodes, they'll take us on a deep dive into the DPL2, with interviews and conversation with contributors to share insights from the planning, research, writing, and editing process, and in the season finale, to take a look back at how the first edition of the DPL started 30 years ago.
At IVP Academic, we are unabashed book nerds, and if that label suits you too, we're pretty sure you're going to find Behind the Books fascinating and fun. Let's go.
Hi, my name is Scott McKnight. About 7 years ago, I was having breakfast with John Boyd at a breakfast restaurant not too far from where I was teaching. And I don't remember all the conversation that we were talking about. John and I have known one another for a long time, and he had recently become major editor at InterVarsity Press. And I just said to him, I said, John, we need to have a new edition of the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters, the way you're redoing the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels. What I didn't know is that I think a half a dozen people had approached him about this, or had approached InterVarsity, and they wanted to do it too. But somehow, John, I had conversations with the people at InterVarsity, and he invited me to participate along with what I thought were two exceptional colleagues to participate in this dictionary, Lynn Kohick, who's done work on Paul, and Nijay, who's more of a Pauline specialist, Nijay Gupta. And then we started having meetings. But to me, it was a belief that we needed a new dictionary, because I found myself increasingly frustrated when I would turn to the old DPL. It just wasn't along the lines of what I was thinking about Paul. And I thought, we need to get a new generation of scholarship involved in this, because there's so much stuff that has gone on in Paul. And what I think the astounding thing for me was, in our conversations in selecting authors, and we could discuss this, was the number of people who were invited who were really at the forefront of these conversations, and some of whom I had never heard of. And Lynn brought in her own context, and Nijay brought in his. And at the time, one of the editors, InterVarsity, she had her own ideas of some people that we could bring in. And the next thing you know, we have quite a list of diverse contributors to this dictionary. And it just grew and grew and grew. And I'm so proud of the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters, number 2, of just the different voices that we read about. I was just looking at the article in Israel, and a wonderful piece. So,
Scott, as you're talking about that, and hi, Nijay and Scott, good to see you. I remember being in the IVP corporate office in a room that had maybe a million post-it notes around as we were, brainstorming. Nijay was coming up with, I don't know, 5 ideas for 1 or 2 articles, options of contributors. And it was an intense couple of days as we tore through those post-it notes.
But I think, Lynn, you're right. One of the things that's so important is a dictionary of all these, when you have this many contributors, it is the people chosen who make the dictionary. And it's not like, okay, we're going to talk about Paul and it's going to all be alike. In the old dictionary, it just seemed to me that the circle of names was so much smaller or homogeneous compared to the diversity that we get in this one. So that's right.
One thing I noticed when we had sat down, Lynn, I remember I was going to mention that same little room with the post-it notes. One thing that really struck me is I think because of technology and social media and just the way we communicate over email, I'm guessing we were working with a lot younger people for this dictionary than the first dictionary. More people in their 40s, maybe people in their 30s, people that are maybe associate professors, things like that. Because I think for the first dictionary, I just wonder if, you know, they're getting these recognized scholars who have written many, many books. But with this one, you know, we know from conferences, we know from social media, we know from personal friendships. So, you know, I think what's really amazing part of this dictionary is getting people in their middle of their career, maybe even in the early part of their career, because we know they're already experts because of their dissertation in X, Y, and Z. That's kind of cool to not have a dictionary as just the activity of kind of people on the brink of retirement or something like that, but to have it as a cross section.
Yeah, like me and like me and Scott. Is that it?
No,
AJ?
No,
like
that's not.
Okay,
what I was
all
saying.
Right. Very nicely said.
You're distinguished.
There you go. At least to my dog.
Let me just say a little bit about what you say. The first dictionary. I think you're talking about the Dictionary of Paul and His Letters. I participated in the first dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, and everything was by paper.
Yes.
And we were sending. I have two file folders. Now, they're not file folders. They're cardboard boxes that would hold old-fashioned file folders. Two full cardboard boxes in my attic of the original dictionary articles for Jesus and the Gospels. And we had to read them in paper and make remarks on them in paper. And then we would send emails. You couldn't attach a document to an email at that time. You could send a letter. And some of the letters were also sent by snail mail, I guess we call it today. Or maybe that's old-fashioned as well. But that, it took so much more work. And it was so much longer and more tedious than it is today when we can digitally communicate with authors immediately. I mean, we've had, in the process of editing these entries, sometimes I would email the author and say, is this what you meant? And then I would correct it on the spot. It would take 15, 20 seconds. So yeah, that's a big part of it. Let me ask what your contributions were, your participation in the previous dictionaries. But I want to say this. I don't know if you two know this, but my mission was to participate in every dictionary in the whole process.
Oh, really?
All the Old Testament ones as well.
Really?
So I participated in every one of the New Testament. Then they started the Old Testament ones. And I did Cain in the Pentateuch.
You want just your hand in it somewhere.
I just wanted to be able to say when it was all over that I wrote something in every one of them. And one of the volumes, I think it was the Prophets, said to Dan Reed, who was running the show at the time, he said, we're not going to have McKnight write an article in this dictionary. So I got shut out. I think it was
close.
I did get to participate in most of them. But what were your contributions to other dictionaries in the series?
I was asked, this is kind of funny. I was asked for the second edition of the Dictionary of Jesus' Gospel in the Gospels to do fasting. So it's funny because I don't write on fasting and I don't write on Jesus and the Gospels, really. And I thought to myself, oh, they must have not had a first version of that in the original dictionary. They did. I think it was maybe Robert Banks. I don't know. It was good. So I was really scratching my head. I did it because I like Scott, I wanted to be in the dictionary. So I have a little tiny entry on fasting. It was heavily edited. It was just sort of an amateur saying, okay, I think this works. I was really pleased, but I was just a seminary student when I first kind of learned about those older dictionaries, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. I remember revering those dictionaries, just looking through the table of contents, looking through the names of the contributors, and just being kind of in awe of kind of the grandeur of these projects. But I was just a student at that time.
Yeah, I did enjoy doing some essays for the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels. I looked at Judaism at that time, common Judaism, Pharisees, and yeah, took a look at also the trial of Jesus, looking at that in the Gospels. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was wandering into new territory from my Paul days, but I enjoyed it very much.
Lynn, I'm curious, what excited you most about being involved with the DPL2, what we call the DPL2?
Yeah. For me, I was really excited about the idea that we were going to pull together scholars from around the globe and be very intentional about women and minoritized voices. And I think that that was always a value that we had in that those meetings with all the post-it notes. We constantly were asking ourselves, are we including essays that would attend to questions that happen around the world in Pauline scholarship? I think one of the fun things about this Dictionary of Paulinist Letters too, is that we pull from people from all kinds of expertise. And one of the people that contributed, his name is Jay Moses, and he wrote the essay Interpretation Jewish. So the Jewish interpretation of Paul. And I had a chance to meet him just serendipitously at a Panera at lunch one time. I was with a friend of mine who's Jewish. She and I were having lunch and Jay came in. She knew him, so made the introduction. Jay's never had a full-time teaching role. He's been a full-time pastor, but he's been in for, I don't know, decades probably, in interfaith dialogue with Jews and Christians. So he seemed a perfect source to be able to write this essay. And I feel like we tried that over and over again, that we wanted to get those people who had a level of expertise rather than just kind of think, you know, who are the people we always see at the annual meetings?
Yeah, I love those serendipitous meetings.
And there's so many people like this that came up in our conversations when we were talking. You know, we would, let's say, get to an essay. I mean, some of the entries we asked the original author if they wanted to revise.
Right.
And most of them, some of them didn't. Some of them did. Some of them were no longer interested in working like that on that kind of entry. But Nijay would bring up a name, and Lynn would bring up a name, and I would bring up a name, and Anna Gissing would bring up a name. And the next thing you know, we've got five names. And we're having a pretty serious conversation about things we know about these authors and what they would write and how that would contribute. It was not easy. And there were, of course, then there's so many essays, entries in the dictionary that eventually you're going, wow, we got a lot more to fill. But I found the discussions about the various scholars to be very, very helpful in helping us understand what we could accomplish with this dictionary. I mean, I remember that when we got Michael Gorman, I thought that was just outstanding to get him to write for us. I thought that was going to make a great contribution. I didn't know if a lot of people knew who Stephen Chester was, but I knew he had really good things that he could contribute. So it was this back and forth in a room, and Lynn knew people that nobody else knew. Nijay knew a lot of these younger scholars. Anna Gissing knew people that we didn't know, and these were conversations that really make a big difference in this dictionary. So
one of my favorite parts is, you know, we added a huge section on hermeneutics and interpretation. I ended up overseeing a lot of that. I was kind of surprised. This isn't really a knock on the first edition. I was surprised that there weren't really history of interpretation stuff on Paul in the first dictionary. Now, I didn't really come of age as a Pauline scholar until the 21st century. So I just didn't know what was normal in the 80s and 90s. But to be able to have entries on Reformational, medieval, patristic, Calvin, Augustine, and then to have it from various kind of cultural locations as well, I mean, that is a profound gift. I think one of the things that happened with this dictionary, the second edition, is really an expansion of the scope of what falls under Pauline studies. I kind of feel like the first dictionary was, number one, relatively traditional, which is not bad. And number two, kind of tried to align with central evangelicalism. You can correct me if I'm completely off here. But I think what we're trying to do is really broaden the tent. And we, you know, we made choices about who would fit and who wouldn't for an InterVarsity Press dictionary. But I think we really broadened the tent of who's in the conversation. Would you guys say that's correct?
Well, I can tell you the first meeting we had on the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospel, we spent probably at least a half an hour discussing whether we could have a Roman Catholic.
You're talking about the original dictionary.
In the original dictionary. That was where evangelicalism at InterVarsity was at the time, whether that would be appropriate.
Did you have a Roman Catholic?
I don't believe we did.
Okay.
I think one view in the room was that Catholics can be evangelicals, and another room was no, because evangelicals are Protestants. They're not Catholics.
Right.
So there was that conversation. But yes, this is a broader mindset. And I think it's the contribution of the editors and the people they know and their perspective. So yeah, I'm wondering who you brought to the table that, if you can remember some voices, I'll go first on this just so you have time, that you said, I knew these people, nobody else in the room knew these people, and they have written really excellent pieces in the dictionary. Okay, so the first one for me was Christopher Hocklatubby.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I had read his book, Civilized Piety, from Baylor. And if I remember right, when I brought his name to the table, nobody knew who he was. And he's an extraordinary scholar, Native American, who really knows his stuff very well. And he wrote an incredible piece. And another one that I brought into the conversation, and I think Nijay knew the person, and I don't know if Lynn do, was Lynn Kidson. I knew she had just finished her dissertation. It wasn't published at Macquarie University on the pastoral epistles on 1 Timothy chapter 2. And when she sent her piece in, I just thought, oh, this is really fun. This is someone who is at the beginning of her academic career. She's not 30 years old or anything, you know, but she at the beginning of her academic career, and she has made an outstanding contribution to a dictionary entry on the pastoral epistles. Chris Hocklatubby did one on Savior, but he could have done pastoral epistles as well. So,
yeah.
So who are ones that you remember bringing to the table?
Lynn, do you have quick ones that come to mind?
Well, I thought of Jay Moses. And did you guys know Barry Danilak?
No.
Okay, so he did our essay on singleness, and Barry has been a pastor for a long time. I got to know him when he did his MA in biblical exegesis at Wheaton College. He's always been interested in the topic of singleness, and he ended up getting his PhD in Cambridge, I think, and continued to work in the church for a long time. But he also now just recently heads up a nonprofit that tries to help churches involve singles at all levels, just empower single adults in ministry. So, yeah, so that's one person I can think of.
What about Amy Krall? Did you know her?
No.
Okay. That could have been Nijay or...
Yes. I had interviewed her for a job at one point, and I knew her kind of through that. She did a great job, so I knew she'd be really good for the dictionary. I think last minute, we had some needs, and we called upon the Jasons, Jason Staples and Jason Myers. And I think we got both of them to help us out with some kind of people backed out or people were unwell. There was one occasion where, yeah, someone was unwell and we had to have somebody step in and help co-write with them. I had a contact that did that. You know, I know all of us claim Lucy Pepe, but there are a few articles that we all get really excited about. I think her work in the Dictionary on Women is really, really good. I'm excited about that. I'm just going on some of my favorite articles because I don't remember who recruited who, but I think getting Matt Bates. Did Matt do Gospel? I can't remember which one Matt did, but I remember enjoying that one and Josh Jipp doing one that was really good as well on Messiah or Christ, one of those.
Yeah. And one of the things I think we all commented at different times to each other on, we could probably count on one hand and not use all our fingers, the number of poorly written essays that we received. I mean, we'd read the essay, and because let's say Nijay or I would get the essay first and we'd go through. And, you know, typically my response would be, my word, this is awesome. And maybe there would be, you know, one or two follow-up questions it was just remarkable the high quality that everyone, whether they were starting out new in their field, I'm thinking of like Peter Gurry, he did textual criticism, you know, newer in the discipline in the academy. And then David Instone Brewer doing Marriage and Divorce. Like this guy is, you know, the one you always go to. Yeah. So both those essays and every other one was just phenomenal. So I think you touched on it a little bit, Nijay, but a low point, I think, for all of us were these unforeseen circumstances that would come up in a few of our authors who wanted to participate, and then circumstances came up. And I feel like we all felt we had a pretty deep bench, right? You know, going back to that post-it note image, there were a lot of people we felt, you know, could do a super job. And so that was great that, you know, they were able to step in.
And Lynn, you've brought up something that's so important to how this worked. I think the official invitation came from InterVarsity Press. The editors would send out the invitations. people would respond. Then we would be notified that so-and-so has agreed to do it, and here's the date at which it's due. But they would go, the essays would be submitted to Nijay or to Lynn first, and then you would pass it on to me. And it always helped me, because I had to read all of them. It helped me when, you know, Nijay or Lynn would say, this is really, really good. And I'd think, well, Nijay knows a lot about this subject, or Lynn knows a lot, so we don't have to worry that much. But then other times, you folks would like the essay, and then I would have a little bit of a criticism. I want to see this, something else contributed here. Or we would have quite a few remarks that this person's got to do some revisions here. And then I would read it and I'd say, yeah. You know, so it was a process of two editors reading. And I think there were a few dictionary articles where we actually all three read it. And then Anna Gissing, who was at InterVarsity at the time, she had to read these essays. And so it's a process, and it takes a long time from the time these articles are, let's say, invited and accepted to where they're actually submitted and clean copy and they can start editing them.
I am so thankful for Google Docs. We made a decision early on to use Google Docs and kind of a master Google spreadsheet, because the idea of trying to send Word documents back and forth. And I have the hardest time figuring out how to store revisions of Word docs of, you know, whenever I work with another publisher and I'm doing Word docs. I knew that once we decided to use Google Docs, we could look at the same thing, know that it was the most updated thing, that we could see each other's comments in real time. So Scott, when you're talking about, you know, the original dictionaries and just stacks of paper, and what if you lose something or spill coffee on it? And I just thought, what an age we live in where we can have these Google Docs and change things in real time. I could see sometimes I'd hop on a document and maybe Anna was in there at the exact same time.
Yes.
Or every now and again, Scott or Lynn was in the exact same time. I could see them writing comments or making comments. I will say one funny thing, and this is just an insight into how editors work. My personality is I wanted all the articles to conform to a certain structure. And I remember, Scott, you pushed back and I'm like, shouldn't all the articles have the same structure and form? I was like, no, let people's personalities come through. Let their, you know, and I thought, okay, if that's the pattern, that's fine. It turned out beautiful, but it's just funny when you have these personalities come together. I always wanted to be like, they should all be exactly the same.
Well, there is a sense in which dictionaries have that scientific feel. And that it would be a certain method that would be. But, you know, you're not going to get Edith Humphrey. You're not going to get them to write the same kind of piece. One is very creative and one's more of a scientist type. Then we always allowed the authors who had specialty in something to go off in their direction. They had to be careful not to be, in a sense, plagiarizing their own work and just grabbing paragraphs from something that was not permissible. But we gave authors considerable freedom, and I think that's one of the important distinctives of this dictionary, is its contribution is you feel like that author is telling you something. I don't feel that the dictionary feels like a dictionary. Yes, of course, you look at it, and it's got two columns, and it's got small print. It does have that sense, but there is a freedom, I think, with the essays that really comes through.
What were some of the innovations that we included? I think our interpretation section an innovation and really helpful. I've already mentioned Jay Moses's Jewish interpretation. Carlos Sosa, who is at Wheaton College, when I was there, a colleague of mine, and he does Latinamente, I think is what we included.
I thought that was a really great title for it, because we wrestled over what was the appropriate terminology. Because you have Latino, you have Latinx. Nothing is going to please everybody. I think probably Carlos came up with that himself. I thought it was a brilliant solution to use kind of an indigenous term that kind of sidesteps some of those complexities. I love that.
And I also thought, like, we have Jennifer McNutt, who is a church historian, expert on Calvin and Geneva and the French Bible. And she'll be looking at interpretation, Calvin's lens, you know, looking at Paul that way. So I feel like we pulled from a variety of people, in part because we really expanded the ways in which the number of essays, we expanded the number of essays to try and include how many different approaches there are to the Apostle Paul I think that makes it also a really interesting read.
Scott, I don't know if I'm exposing too much here, but I think you might know this. Did the old dictionary, did you tell me once the old dictionary had maybe a chip against on its shoulder against the new perspective? Because those conversations were happening around that time, right? This is the 80s, 90s. And I'm just looking here, as Lynn was talking about, we have a section on new perspective. We have a whole bunch of stuff on Paul and Judaism, Israel. We're being sensitive to the Jewish context of Paul and the early Christians. Am I correct that there were maybe some sensitivities about the new perspective in the old dictionary? Because obviously you and I have staked our claim with the new perspective as you know, students or friends of Jimmy Dunn. Do you recall how that worked in the first
degree? Oh, yes, I do recall. I mean, let's just face it. He who writes the story controls the glory, right? The people who wrote in that first DPL were in the traditional, depending how you call it now, the old perspective, the Reformation perspective, the whatever you want to call it. And I don't think that the terms need to be denigrating. Yes, and they were much more along that line. And I don't remember if N.T. Wright or Jimmy Dunn were writing, but I know the influence of their ideas were nowhere near as pervasive then as they are now. But our dictionary has moved beyond that discussion to a broader sense of Paul. And, you know, when you're dealing with Michael Gorman, you're not dealing with the new perspective, and you're dealing with a broader sense. You know, he's got his own kind of participationist theology. So yes, I do think that the older dictionary minimized the significance of the new perspective simply because the people they chose to write. I believe we brought the new perspective back into it in some ways, without saying this is not a new perspective dictionary. This is a broad perspective dictionary.
Right.
You can pronounce his name, Ekaputra.
Yeah.
Tupamahu.
You got it.
Did I do it? Okay.
You got it.
I mean, this sort of essay that he wrote on Asian and Asian American interpretation and post-colonial, this just broadens the entire discussion. And I think our students and readers and pastors who read this dictionary, if they wander into an essay like that, they'll go, wow, this is taking me in new places. So,
yeah. And having Stephen Chester write Paul and Luther just provide that scope, right? I think we were, in our appreciation for the first edition, really wanting to keep all that historical perspective. Not everything is new.
Okay. I want to tell you how I use this dictionary now. I think people should know that Lynn and I and DJ haven't memorized this dictionary. We don't know everything that's in it, and we don't remember everything that we've read. And we've read, you know, like I can say that I've read, I just can't believe that I've read the whole thing, but I have.
Yeah.
I'm writing these little everyday Bible studies, and I need quick information. And not too long ago, I turned to the essay by Louise Gosbo on disability in Paul, and it was so illuminating. And I use this dictionary quite a bit. It sits right next to my desk here. And as I'm writing these little commentaries, I need help and stuff. And Nijay, I think you're the one who suggested Timothy Brookins for the Corinthians.
Yeah.
I think you knew him. I didn't know him.
Yeah.
He's where Lynn is now. He was very helpful for me when I mean, the Corinthian letters are complicated.
Tough.
I've spent a lot of time messing with them, and he was very enlightening for me. This is the kind of thing that I'm necessarily going to quote, but they can provide pastors. They can provide students. They can provide professors who are preparing lectures, especially that first time, some really helpful surveys. And I don't know how you're using the dictionary, but it sits pretty close to where I work all the time.
I'd love to hear maybe some idiosyncratic things that you had when you approached this dictionary. I'll give you an example from me. So one of my favorite entries from the original DPL is the Old Testament and Paul, because there's so much you have to learn, so much information. I just looked it up. It was Moses Silva did the original entry. And we asked Roy Champa to do the new one. He's a big old and the new, studied with Brian Rosner. They co-wrote a great First Corinthians commentary together. And I remember, this is one of my picky things. I said, Roy, there's this wonderful chart that Silva had where he laid out everywhere where Pauline quotations agree with either the Masoretic text or the Septuagint or both or neither. And I was like, can you make sure you update and put in that chart? Because I can't tell you how much I love this chart. So that's going to be one of my like legacies, is that this chart made it into the dictionary. Any things that you guys were really picky about like that? Something you really wanted, an entry you really wanted, or something you were really thrilled about?
I don't remember having that conversation that I wanted something in the dictionary. I felt like when we sat in the university press offices in the old camp where they were, they have a beautiful new campus now, where they were, that we had such an amazingly long list of possible entries or essays and a list of authors, potential authors, that adding anything to that was a bit of a fool's game. But that interpretation section is the distinctive contribution. And I don't remember who brought that to the table. So I do remember asking Rodney Reeves, I believe. Didn't Rodney Reeves write one on Paul as pastor or something like that? Rodney's a pastor now. Ministry and spirituality. He had written that wonderful book.
He did one on spirituality.
Yeah, he did one on ministry too. I remember thinking, we need something like that. If this dictionary doesn't help pastors, then we're not doing our job. This is not just for university professors. So
I do remember we had several that were really, really sensitive that we wanted to make sure were done really well. One of them I remember was supersessionism. I think Mike Bird did that one. Another was anything dealing with gender, sexuality, the body. And we had several great authors that leaned into that. But, you know, we knew that some essays are going to be fine. They're just general topics. You know, there's one on like the olive tree or something like that. But then some of them are going to be really, really, they're going to be scrutinized. You know, this dictionary can last for decades, obviously. And so I remember we took extra care. We pored over every word with some of those really, really, really sensitive topics. I want to follow up on what Scott kind of had hinted at in terms of, you know, one of the nice things about doing this podcast now is that we're about a year later after the dictionary came out. So it's kind of interesting to hear how people are using it. So Lynn, I'd be interested to hear how you're using it in your classes or how you've heard from other people. But just real quick, I'll say, even though I love print books and I love how they look and I love how they smell, I actually use the IVP dictionaries on Logos most of the time. I'll pull up an entry. I know Scott's chagrined by this, but I tend to use it digitally and I tend to recommend my students get it digitally, even though I love the print books. But Lynn, how have you used it in your classes? What sorts of classes, or how have you heard people using it around the country, around the world?
Yeah, I don't know that I can add much to what you all have said. I think the fact that it's accessible, I guess that's how I would summarize what people have indicated to me. It's delightful to read. You know, you think of a dictionary, and although it's a useful term, I'm not questioning that, but we tend to think dictionary is just purely utilitarian, but it actually is enjoyable. Like, it's something you could just sit down and say, let the pages fall open, except for Nietzsche, because there's no pages.
Yes.
And okay, what's here? Let me take a look at it. So that's what I've heard. Yeah.
Okay, Lynn, do you use it in paper or do you use it digitally?
Paper.
Yeah.
Let everything be established in the mouth of two or three witnesses.
But see, if I use it on Logos, I can increase the font at will. So there's some inherent benefits to the digital.
Yeah, yeah. I'll listen to you on that one with my eyes. But yes, but I use it. I use it quite a bit. In fact, I think they sent each one of us, what was it, 3 or 4 copies?
Yeah.
I can't remember it. Yeah. And I have one upstairs. I have one in where I'm sitting at this desk, and I have another room with books in another room. And when I'm in that room, I just use the other one that I have there. So
just put one in every room.
Yeah.
And so I get to use it in different places, but I got to have it near me because it gives me so much information quickly with a very accessible and clear organization.
Well, here's a question. Do you use both dictionaries? Because I actually will, if I'm studying something, especially something I don't know much about, I'll actually check both because I could just pull them up so quickly on Logos. So do you check both?
I wouldn't say I feel the need to do that all the time.
I do sometimes, but most of the time I just go because I think these are updated essays as well.
Also, there's such a high degree of academic rigor that you really can feel very confident. I feel very confident. I open the essay and what they're writing there can be, you know, it's solid. It's absolutely solid. That's really nice too.
One of the great contributions of these dictionaries for me over the years, and I know this is the case with students, is the bibliographies at the end of every entry. And if that is, if they've done their job, and frankly, at times I said to an author, we need to add this piece of bibliography, and you need to at least look through this because this is important, and maybe you didn't know about it or you forgot it or didn't have access to it. Those bibliographies can be so helpful, and they will be good for at least 10 years. And I know these things have to be updated. And I never imagined when I sat with Dan Reed in about 1990 or 89 at a restaurant that we would be not only doing a first edition, but second editions of these dictionaries.
Yeah.
And I think that I have all of them lined up on a top shelf because they're so heavy. They have to be, and they're so big, they have to be at the top. But I have all of them lined up, and I use each dictionary on a routine basis. So
let me ask you a research question in terms of how you managed your time with a project like this, because I know you guys are busy with work. You're also busy maybe doing other research projects. And this is probably the most time-consuming project I've done that takes several years. I can't remember how many years, but it was several years. So I know, Lynn, you're very methodical with how you use your time. Scott, you have your own systems. How did you plan out your weeks so that you made regular time for this? Or, I mean, I know you're not just doing it randomly. I know you're doing it in a very methodical way. So tell me how you carved out, because it's an intimidating thing. And then to also have a personal research agenda as well. So how did you actually plan your time to make time for this?
I don't know that. Well, I guess, as you said, I'm methodical. So I guess I, you know, you put it on your to-do list and it becomes part of what you're doing. I will say that I didn't put it off until, for me, late at night when I can't think clearly. This was a high priority. And so I wanted to look at it at a time when I could take my time to look at things. But as you were talking, I was referring to some of my notes that I made for this podcast, one of which, when they talked about, well, what was one of a low point? It was when I would get an email from Anna. Okay, we have another batch of you that we have to look at.
Batch.
It was like, oh, it wasn't the individual essays. They were always inspiring to read and informative and interesting and engaging and all that. But the batch, when I got the batch email, that's when my heart kind of sunk. Because that was more, it felt to me, tedious, making sure transliterations were correct.
Yes.
And oh my gosh.
That's good. I definitely have the same feeling about the word batch. Here's a new batch. And it would be pages of the actual TypeScript. You know, they were like galleys. But I'm methodical in this way. Almost nothing interrupts my mornings from, let's say, 6:15 to 11 o'clock. That's my reading, my research, my writing time. In the afternoons, I don't write. If I do, it's only because there's a real crunch. I never write in the evenings, and I never write on weekends. So in afternoons are my reading time, where I'm reading broadly, depending on maybe where I'm going to be writing next, something else, or something that I just need to be reading because it's New Testament studies. And I would occasionally go over to the tab on my computer and look, and there's some more essays. I remember one time I looked and there were about 30. And I went, oh no. So I just spent, let's say, the next week or two or three essays every day. I think trying to read 15 of them all at once just was unproductive for me. I wasn't as good an editor as I needed to be. And so I just read the dictionary essays that were submitted in the afternoons in my reading time. And then, of course, when they came in as edits, that's where Anna Gissing and the people at InterVarsity had to take care to make sure that they followed up on the essays. But, you know, this was a lifetime type experience, one of our career choices that we've made. And every time we can walk by the shelves in libraries or our own libraries or other people's libraries and see one of these dictionaries, you two and I look at those and say, I know a lot about that dictionary. We were involved in that. And I'm proud of this dictionary. I'm as proud of this dictionary as it is fat. And it is a big old dictionary. And you can sprain your fingers and your thumbs picking it up and using it. But I think it's been a noble experience. And I believe that we have contributed to the church and to the scholarly world, to the pastoral church world, in ways that will bear fruit for a generation of young scholars who will now be saying, I hope I'm the next editor of the next DPL3, which will be 15 years from now.
Yeah.
So I want to thank InterVarsity and the editors there, as well as you, Lynn and Nijay, for your sterling contributions. I would not have done this dictionary if I didn't think that the people that I was working with were just exactly the kind of people we needed to work with. So I want to thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Yes, absolutely a pleasure. And the fun doesn't stop here, because each of us are going to be doing some interviews with specific contributors, which will be really fun. So, and we'll get a chance to talk as well with the man that you've mentioned earlier, Scott, Dan Reed, in one of our final episodes. So I hope people stick around and listen to the episodes that we have coming up, and you guys will have your own interviews as well. And it'll be fun.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Behind the Books from IVP Academic.
Join us next week when Scott McKnight talks with Michael Gorman.
Behind the Books is a production of IVP Academic. For more information on any IVP titles mentioned in this episode, visit ivpress.com and use code IVPOD25. That's IVPOD25 for 25% off. Sound engineering by Honest Podcasts. Our producers are Alexandra Horn and Travis Albritton. Our production assistants are Christine Policio-Mello and Jack Reese. Our hosts are Scott McKnight, Lynn Kohick, Nijay Gupta, John Boyd, and Alexandra Horn. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and leave a rating and review to support the show.